Okay, yeah, it's basically Ethernet cable. If you look at any kind of Ethernet cable that's connected, the old standard was less leads, but anything from 100 megabytes to the gigabyte copper-stranded cables are four pairs of four twisted pairs, and that goes into an RJ45 connector. So you could use them. I don't know if you would really want to use them as transmission line because they're not really designed with specific impedances. Theoretically, you could take the wires and then separate them and make them into open line. I don't think that would be a great idea because they're a bit fragile. You could use them maybe even just as radiators, just as random pieces of wire to run antennas. Again, they're kind of thin, a little fragile probably mechanically, but you can give it a try.
I have a question. Would it be too easy?
Yes, Ed.
I think Kay has an application in mind. I find that fascinating, what she wants to do, or is this just an academic exercise?
What I'm looking for is suggestions on what I can do with this wire once I identify what it is. Maybe make antenna out of it, maybe make a transmission line, which, you know, Ray just said wouldn't be a good idea. But there are seven small, thin wires inside this casing, not eight. And they're not, they're red, white, and green. There's no brown ones, and they're not multiply packaged. This is threesomes.
Did you ever gut a fish?
As a matter of fact, no, but that's on my bucket list. AC2LR.
That's what you do with this. You take a sharp razor knife, you cut the outer plastic, and you save the 22-gauge solid wires for hookup wire.
And what would I be saving them for?
I use it for various projects, but if you're not building any projects, you really don't have much use for it.
Okay, just as wire connectors then, rather than antenna or transmission line with a radio?
Yeah, I would advise using more dedicated wires for those purposes. It's not like they're that expensive. Do it right. That's my take. WB2EAV.
I would certainly agree with Ed as far as transmission line because, as Andy mentioned, they have specific characteristic impedances that are important, and they're designed to have a consistent impedance across the length of the transmission line. So if you were to jury-rig something using random pieces of insulated wire, it's doable, but it's probably not worth the effort. And again, I mean, theoretically, you could use it as just radiating antenna wire. There's nothing against that. As long as you keep in mind the mechanical limitations of a thin gauge like that. So, you know, again, as mentioned, there's probably thicker gauge wire, not necessarily wire that says you can use this for antennas, but just if it's mechanically more sturdy, would probably be better for radiating antennas. As he mentioned, you know, this would be just kind of spare wire if you were making connections and playing with little circuits and fixing, you know, open circuits and such. And, you know, a lot of people can always use a little bit of wire.
DDH Bell wire.
Yeah, John first and then Ed. John.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the impedance. When I was at Bell Labs in Naperville, the network clock frame used a twisted pair, I think it was 22-gauge twisted pair, to conduct around a 16.384 megahertz clock signal. The characteristic impedance of that, I think, was around 91 ohms. but it's okay for low power stuff, but I wouldn't use it for any high frequency RF. But this was Kevlar insulated wire, so it was a fairly decent dielectric, but it was twisted pair, and I'm pretty sure it was 22 gauge, and I remember the characteristic impedance did work out when you did the L per unit length and C per unit length, worked out to be around 91 ohms. Go ahead. Okay, I assume that a twisted pair has its own inherent impedance. Unfortunately, Kay's description was that they're not twisted pairs. They don't seem to be Ethernet cables, as we've all been sort of presuming with four pair of twisted pairs. Instead, her cable is color-coded differently than category 4, 5, 6, etc., and is not, I don't think, is twisted, because there are seven wires in that shield. That sounds like it's outside plant, old phone wire, the outside plant cable. Go ahead.
Yeah, back in the 50s, they used that stuff for wiring up phones.
Yeah, that's what I think it is, yeah. Okay, very good. So I agree with you. It's probably... So there's no particular inherent twisted pairs, and there's no inherent impedance. You kind of make your own by whatever you do to the set of wires. So once again, you know, copper is copper. You could probably sell it if it was enough copper in it. But otherwise, it's more for making little small wire connections to circuits and such. I don't think it really translates that well, unfortunately, to antennas because of the fragility, and the transmission lines because of the impedance problem.
KD2FIU.
Yeah, George.
How long is this wire?
I have about 20 yards of it.
Does it appear to have an outside endurance type of outer shielding to it?
Just the regular rubber casing that you'd see around a telephone wire. And John and I think it was Ed nailed it, because the guy who threw it out is a retired telephone worker from about 30 years ago.
Okay, well, when he threw it out, I guess really doesn't matter. And it's 22 gauge. It could be a 20 gauge, 22 gauge Ashley CC wire, copper coated steel. So it has value, not in any type of monetary value, but you can use this for even antenna wire. You can use this for radios, for antennas, and you could also use this as conductor wire to control rotators for some distance. But that's something you may want to hold on to for any antenna projects in the future, if it's not taking up a lot of room.
Excellent rotator wire, but not strong enough for a radiator.
Oh, no. Strong enough for a radiator and radials.
I wouldn't trust it. That stuff sticks and breaks very easily.
They were using copper-coated steel since 1925 for drop runs.
Yeah, but that's a steel core. This is.
How do you know?
I know this stuff. I got 60 yards of it when I was a kid, and I still have about half of it.
Does it run the same everywhere for every length? So we don't know. I just said maybe it is. Remember, this is solid wire. They have not used solid copper since the 1920s.
No, that's not true at all. Oh, wait, you mean the phone company?
Definitely.
Yeah, maybe the phone company, but there's still plenty of solid wire being used every day.
She's mentioning that it is a phone wire. If it's a tip and ring 48 ground wire, it's been in copper clad steel since the 1920s.
That is pretty useless altogether.
I wouldn't think. Oh, no, no. That's not easy to come by.
I would assume that you could pretty much figure out what its center is if you just take a simple knife and just scrape along the conductor and see if the middle of it turns from copper to kind of a steely gray.
Or just take a good solid pair of dice and cut it.
Well, yeah, I mean, but then you probably need a good magnifying lens to see exactly, because, you know, 22 gauge is kind of tiny, so I don't know how much of it is steel. I would think, again, it would be easier to visualize if you just scrape off the copper cladding, if that's what's going on.
No, I'm just saying, with a good pair of diagonal cutters, if you feel any resistance to steel, if it's copper, go through it like butter.
82 FIU.
Yeah, George.
Yeah, aerial outside runs for drop lines were never less than 20 gauge.
Okay, I mean, I don't know what to tell Kay. You know, there are devices that very quickly will tell you the gauge of wire. It's always nice to have one of them. If it's actually copper clad steel, I wouldn't really use it, as Ed mentioned, as hookup wire. You might want to try it out as radials. You might want to try it out as temporary wire antennas. But again, it depends upon what the gauge it is. If it's 20, you know, that might be passable. 22, even if it's steel centered, I don't, and it's, you know, how many years and who knows under what exposure it had, I don't know.
WD2EAV was my final comment on the subject.
Yes, indeed, Ed. Please give us your final point on that subject.
If you assume it is copper-coated steel and do something as copper-coated steel and it turns out you're wrong, my blood runs cold at the disaster you're building. You don't want to play that game.
Ed, I was under the impression here, from what I heard, that this was outside telephone line wire. Is that correct?
Yeah, but we're talking about using a load-bearing application as a guy wire.
I didn't say guy wire. I said radials. You could use this for radios, for aerial antennas. You could make antennas out of this if you want. If it's 20 gauge copper coated steel, you have nice antenna wire available. That's all I said. That's why I came in. I didn't expect every other application to come along with it. If it's outside telephone company drop line wire for tip and ring, battery and ground, it's going to be 20 gauge CCA since 1925. That's it. And by drop, I mean to the house, to the premise.
Question. I hope the ruminations help you.
By drop line, I mean to the premise, to the house. I'm not talking about running aerial pole to pole. If it's drop wire that went to the house, it has value. strong wire, and it is copper clad steel wire.
Okay. Thank you very much, George. Thank you very much, Ed. And again, thank you to Kay for bringing up the subject. I think we've been kicking this dead horse for a while now. So just as a little bit of a, since I brought up the subject, although didn't seem to get a lot of interest, the YouTube video that I posted that I want you to take a look at, the guy tests the resistance of a copper pipe with a voltmeter. He tests the copper resistance of a similarly dimensioned carbon pipe, and it shows the same numbers flash on the meter. The problem is you don't measure the short length of copper pipe or even carbon pipe with a voltmeter. The errors are way too high for that. You would need a micro-ohmmeter to measure properly the micro-ohm resistance of the difference between copper and carbon. And if he did that, he would notice that carbon, although conductive, is about 1,000 to 10,000 times less conductive than copper. And so when he threw the neodymium magnet through the pipe that was made out of carbon, it didn't slow down at all, because that difference in resistance was enough to undermine Lenz's law effect, and it was overpowered completely by gravity. So the proper equipment for the proper job, if you want to measure resistance on things that have very, very low resistance, you use a micro-ohmmeter. You don't use a generic voltmeter. That was just the point of that one.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
I just want to tie things together, a little suggestion. Maybe Kay can give the wire to Les to make his 6-meter helix antenna.
Okay, that's a nice way of having everything kind of go around and meet up at the beginning.
And the helix does that too.
Well, I don't know. Does a helix really do that? It does that. It sort of does that. I was thinking of a word that I always have problems pronouncing, Ouroboros, which is basically a symbol of a snake eating its own tail.
I was just speaking metaphorically.
Okay. Yeah, as good as any. Like I said, even the snake eating its own tail is pretty much a metaphor, because I don't think much of that goes on. It's somewhat counterproductive. Anyway, want to thank everyone tonight, certainly Andy and the participants, Ed and Lou and John and Craig, and I'm sure there's a bunch of other people that I totally forgot, unfortunately. Thanks to the people with the questions, thanks to the people who offered answers, and thanks to everyone who listened in. Again, want to remind you right before we go up to Space Report that if you have any questions, if you can't get onto the net itself, or if you have any puzzles or such, or if you want me to ask Paul to talk about some subject, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And the link page is roy.ac2gs.com. And always remember that Mike, AC2NJI, has a couple met that go as far back as September of 2006. So, thanks all. I'll be back again a little bit later, but here is Paul, WS2N, with the Space Report.
AC2GS, WS2N. Very good, Roy. Great topic tonight. So, let me just start off with a launch that took place yesterday. An Ariane 5 took off from South America, from French Guiana, what's called Kourou. And that's where the European Space Agency launches their rockets. They have three different size rockets that they launch from there. The small version is the Vega,
and then they actually launch a Soyuz rocket, which they always buy from Russia, and they just reconfigure it for their medium payload launches. And then they have heavy lift vehicle, which is the Ariane 5. And none of these rockets have been launched since March because of the COVID virus. So in May, they started to bring people back, and they finally got to launch the Ariane 5 yesterday, which successfully put three satellites into orbit, two communication satellites into geosynchronous orbit. And then another interesting one built by Northrop. Northrop Grumman built another mission extension vehicle, they call it. This is called MEV-2. It's the second launch of this type of vehicle. They launched one earlier this year. What it does is the goal is to attach to a geosynchronous satellite that's been up there for many years and or might be failing, doesn't have any fuel left. Once in a while, they have to move their location in geosynchronous orbit. Geosynchronous is 23,000 miles up, so it's a good distance from the Earth. And they are planning a fleet of these things. And the last one was the first one back in March. It successfully connected to an Intel cell sat. Geosynchronous satellite, and revived that thing for the next 5 years. Since that was so successful, they decided to send another one. There's another one that's been up there, IntelSat, for 16 years, and that's on its way out. So this thing will eventually, it's going to take a long time to get there, a couple of months to actually align itself put itself into position, and it comes up behind the communication satellite, the aging communication satellite. It has this hook type of thing. It goes inside the thruster, the main thruster of the existing satellite, and then it pulls itself in. It attaches itself to it, and because this new MEV-2 or Mission Extension Vehicle 2 built by Northrop Grumman has plenty of fuel on board, it could revive the keep the satellite operating for at least another 5 more years. After that, there's plenty of fuel left on MEV-2. It'll actually fly off and do the same thing to another satellite. They'll pick one at at that time 5 years down the road. So that's the way the space world is going now, with launches, retrieving boosters, and reusing cargo spacecraft, and reusing manned spacecraft, becoming less expensive. They've launched these satellites in geosynchronous orbit, thinking that they're hoping they get 15 years out of it. Now they're going to get maybe 20 years out of it. Future missions will go one step further with the mission extension type vehicle. They'll eventually start sending them up and actually refueling some of these satellites. Most of the ones up there now have not been planned to be serviced on, but some of the future one will be serviced. I thought I'd bring that up. I thought that was that's a one big step forward for Northrop Grumman, and I'm glad to see the European Space Agency able to resume launches. Let me drop it, see if there's any questions. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Okay, there's another launch that took place, or that will be taking place this Tuesday. I mentioned the Falcon 9 many, many times, and one of the most common groups of satellites that put into space is called Starlink. There's over 600 satellites that SpaceX launch for their broadband service, and they've already launched 9 or 10 flights. Actually, this will be the 10th flight. So they had a preliminary one, so it's going to be over 600 satellites, maybe 660, I think, after this launch on Tuesday. But again, the cost of launching rockets is coming way down. You know, they launch these things on a regular basis now and then reuse the boosters. Some of the boosters have been reused 5 times. These boosters, you know, they're 155 feet high. You know, they're 12 feet in diameter. They come back, land on a drone ship out at sea, or they'll actually land them back at Cape Canaveral, or if they launch from California, they'll bring them back to Vandenberg, California, and reuse these things. So that's another step in the right direction. Let me go on to a completely different topic, unless somebody has any questions. By the way, this is the TechNet. If anybody has a tech question, they want to, this is primarily a TechNet. You can always jump in and do that, and I can always stand by. This is WS2M. Okay, there was a story about Ceres, the asteroid. That's the biggest asteroid in the between Mars and Jupiter in the asteroid belt. Vista is another one. You might remember from many years ago that we had launched a spacecraft to go to Vista and then eventually to Ceres, and it orbited one asteroid and eventually orbited the other big one, Ceres, and took a lot of pictures. They have infrared cameras. They've learned a lot about both our asteroids. One of them was around 300 miles in diameter. This one's bigger, about 600 miles in diameter. So it's got its own gravity and all. And in fact, when it was discovered, they actually were thinking of calling it a planet, and then it got downgraded at one time, realizing that it was part of the asteroid belt. So it's quite a large satellite that's up there. That's Dawn. It's orbited for actually a couple of years. Dawn has an ion engine, and it was able to maneuver between the two different asteroids. Anyway, the pictures and the information has all been evaluated by scientists all around the world, and they came up with this conclusion now that in the inside of Ceres, they believe there's brine or salt water. Now, they did that primarily by a lot of the pictures that they took, especially in the infrared, and they've confirmed that certain substances on the asteroid could only exist if there's a brine interior, you know, or salt water. So they found this compound, hydrohalite, normally only found on Earth, nowhere else. They see it on the surface, and they've pretty much confirmed that this thing is loaded with water. So someday in the future, you know, I envision spacecraft landing on this thing and tapping into the nearby water not too deep under the surface and getting hydrogen and oxygen out of that somehow with the ability with the electrolysis and everything to separate it, and you could refuel spacecraft. Have hydrogen and oxygen, or even oxygen for breathing if it's a human's life. So that was pretty interesting. If I don't have any questions, I'll just continue and move on. This is WS2N. Okay, on this note, I've discussed the Dream Chaser probably for, I don't know, 10 years now, but not longer. Dream Chaser is a spacecraft being built by SNC, Sierra Nevada Corporation. And they were originally building it to have a manned flight, you know, carry up to 7 astronauts. You know, it would fly, launch vertically on top of a rocket, and when it returns, it would land on a runway. Any runway in the world, it uses what they consider a green fuel. It doesn't use dangerous fuels that some of the other ones use, like the shuttle or the X-37B, which is up there now. That's another space-type plane built by Boeing. Only, you know, it's strictly used by the defense, by the government. So this one will be a commercial type of deal. It's designed to bring cargo to the space station. NASA didn't want Sierra Nevada Corporation to use it for manned flights because they had other companies in mind, SpaceX and Boeing. So they eliminated that part of it, but they gave them a contract to launch 6 flights starting late next year to the International Space Station. And once this is built, if there's other space stations that are flying up there or some scientists want, you know, free flying science just to be done without a space station, Dream Chaser will be available as an unmanned vehicle. Their plans are in the future, after using this version of the Dream Chaser, is to actually convert back to a manned system, and they would be able to have both capabilities. But for now, it's a cargo vehicle. It'll launch on the top of an Atlas V rocket, or they actually have the option to launch on top of a SpaceX rocket, or even a European Space Agency Ariane 6. They're flying Ariane 5 now. Next year they're going to start a newer version of the Ariane 5 called the Ariane 6. Anyway, this thing, this Dream Chaser, folds up its wings, and they put it inside the top of the rocket, and they put bearing around it, and they launch it. When in space, the fairing, of course, separates, and essentially the second stage of whatever rocket they're using, either the Falcon 9 or the Ariane 5 or the the Atlas 5, or the near future, the Vulcan rocket, also being built by Boeing and Lockheed, will have that capability. Anyway, after leaving the rocket behind, Dream Chaser will be able to go on to either dock or berth with the space station. Attached to the back of the vehicle, the cargo vehicle itself can hold really only about 2,000 pounds of stuff. But they're building this 16-foot long piece that comes out of the back of the Dream Chaser called a shooting star. And that's where they're going to be able to hold tons of cargo, and I'm not kidding, tons. They'll be able to, like, at least 5 tons, around 10,000 pounds, so plus the other 2,000 pounds. So they'll be able to easily bring up 12,000 pounds to the space station at a time, which will mean they'll be able to bring the most payload up out of all the cargo vehicles that go there now. And when they leave, they'll stay attached for, you know, maybe 4 or 5 months, and then the crew, whoever it might be on the space station, will fill up the shooting star part of it with all the trash and things that they need to be destroyed. And at some point, the Dream Chaser, still attached to the shooting star, will separate from the International Space Station and eventually deorbit. The shooting star part will separate from Dream Chaser before Dream Chaser enters the atmosphere and comes through. Like the shuttle has all kinds of heat protection system on it, a much more modern system where you won't have tiles falling off like you had with the shuttle. And it'll come in for a landing, any runway. It will have that capability. And the scientists will like it because it'll come back on land. They don't have to wait until they fish it out of the sea like they did last month with the Dragon crew vehicle. Scientists like to get their hands on the stuff right away. A lot of it's refrigerated, or specimens and things like that coming back from the space station. So that's the story. The reason I bring it up is they finally gave it a name, and this one is called Tenacity. Probably a year from now, we'll be talking about Tenacity, which is the name given to the Dream Chaser spacecraft. So look forward to that thing flying. I mean, they've already got the contract. Like I said, they'll fly at least six cargo flights to the space station. If that goes well, that will be renewed in the future. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N. Okay, now. Last month, the end of the month, there was a launch by an Atlas V rocket, which carried on top Perseverance, the 2020 rover that's on its way to Mars. And, launched with four solid boosters attached to it, and everything went okay. They had a little communication problem in the beginning. That worked out. They had some temperature problems with the heat radiator. It went below a certain number that it was set for, and that shut everything down temporarily. Went into a safe mode, and eventually NASA, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, brought it back up and got everything running again. They didn't know it was going to get just that cold when it went behind the Earth. Got a little too cold, and it hit a limit. But they got it out of the safe mode. They essentially reboot the computer. On the cruise vehicle. So inside the cruise vehicle, they have this 2,200-pound robot that will eventually land at Jezero Crater in February 18th of next year. And on the bottom of that vehicle, they have the helicopter, two four-foot blades, called Ingenuity, attached to the bottom of it. So when it goes up, it's got a slight charge on the lithium battery. You got to remember, this helicopter only weighs about 4 pounds on Earth. So inside it has a lithium battery, and it's set up with a relatively low charge in it, and that charge starts to go down even lower. So every now and then, over the next 7 months before they get to Mars, they have to recharge his battery. It'll drain a little bit, each day, not being used. And they keep the charge low, around 35% for some reason. I haven't figured that out yet, but in the cruise stage, for 7 months between Earth and Mars, they don't want to give it a full charge. They're happy around 35%. Maybe it has to do with the temperature conditions. I'm not really sure. And eventually, when they do land on Mars, they'll give it a full charge from Perseverance. And Perseverance, the cruise stage has solar panels and everything for keep the cruise stage going. But to charge the helicopter, they actually can pick up two ways, either from solar panels or from the nuclear-powered plutonium-238 that they have on board. So that, you know, that thing, the whole vehicle is not going to be solar panels, no solar panels on the rover itself, just on the helicopter. So after it lands and the helicopter is deployed from the rover, and the rover drives away and leaves the helicopter behind, any recharging will be done by just one solar panel on the top of the shaft. Two blades, they spin in opposite directions, and it, like I said, they're 4 feet long. But on top of that, there's a solar panel that's going to recharge this little battery inside of Ingenuity. So that's the update on that. Now we'll go on, you know, every couple of weeks they'll be charging this thing until it gets to Mars in February. Any questions? This is WS2N for the Technics. Okay, I talk about the Starship a lot. Starship being built by SpaceX. Somebody many months ago was asking, the exact sizes, the size of the spacecraft, and the booth that it's going to be, put up with it. Starship is designed to eventually go to Mars, and in the short term, it'll probably send it to the moon as well. But they've been building one right after the other, and a few of them, quite a few, have failed. Actually, they've blown up. But each time something goes wrong, they immediately finish building another one. I mean, weeks later. They're all made out of stainless steel. And the first one was more or less just a show. The second one, I think, the cap blew off, one of the domes, part of the tank. And maybe the third one actually blew itself apart. They had a disconnect on the liquid methane fuel. That went haywire, and the whole thing just blew up. Inside of like 3 weeks, they had a new launcher set up for, and another rocket coming out. They're building one right after the other down in Texas, a place called Boca Chica, Texas. So anyway, the measurements of the booster, which will be eventually built right now, they're in the process of starting to build it. The diameter will be 30 feet, and the diameter one that they've been testing now, which is essentially the second stage, they call it the Starship. Starship is the second stage that's actually going to be able to re-enter the atmosphere to land back on land vertically. But the Starship that they're building now is also 30 feet in diameter. But it's 160, it'll be, with the crew part on top, it'll be around 160 feet tall. Right now it's around 100 feet tall. This is just recently a 100-foot, looks like a silo, 100 feet, made out of stainless steel, 150 feet tall, 30-foot diameter thing, and they only put one engine on the bottom. These are massive engines. They're called Raptor engines, 450,000 pounds of thrust, able to lift the whole thing. It lifted it off the ground down in Texas. Went about, 150 meters up in the air, so 500 feet up in the air, and translated over to a landing pad and came straight down and successfully landed. Six legs opened up to accomplish that, and it was very successful. And now they're building an SN-6. SN is, stands for Starship, and for number, and it'll be the sixth one that they build. And they're going to try to duplicate that with SN-6, probably within a couple of weeks. And then after that, SN-7, they're just going to use that as a test. They want to just pump it up and pressurize it, see what it can take before it blows up. But then SN-8 will actually probably be the one where they put three Raptor engines on it and see how high they can go. The ultimate goal is to get this thing to fly 20 kilometers up, and and then you know, like 12 miles high, and then come back down and land vertically where I took off from. So anyway, this whole setup, once it has a crew piece on top, pointy part, won't look like a silo anymore, and that's probably what SN8 will look like. The whole length will be 160 feet long, but still 30 feet in diameter. You know, imagine 30 feet in diameter filled up with fuel, you know, up 100 feet. That's a lot of fuel, liquid oxygen and liquid methane. So you figure, well, that's big enough. Now they need the booster. See, this is essentially the second stage I talked about. Now they're building the booster. The booster is like this thing will be like the 160 feet tall. The booster is like 230 feet tall. Again, 30 feet in diameter. And that'll be all filled up with liquid methane, liquid oxygen once that thing is built. Instead of having three engines on the bottom, for the test they had one 450,000 pounds of thrust, which is massive. Instead of having three, like they'll probably have on SN8 and SN9, they plan on putting 31 of these massive engines on the bottom of the booster, and take this other spacecraft that they're testing now with the three engines, which will eventually have six engines, put that on top of the booster. They call it the Heavy. So they have the Heavy and this other thing. Total height will be around 400 feet bottom to top. And those of us that are old enough or young enough to have studied the Saturn V. Saturn V was around, 27 feet, I think, in diameter, but 363 feet high. So this thing will actually be taller than the Saturn V, and it will be putting out a heck of a lot more thrust, probably twice the amount of thrust that the Saturn V did. The Saturn V was 7.5, and it's probably in the, 14 million. They had 7.5 million pounds of thrust, and that will really be something. So his goal eventually is to build a fleet of these monstrous things and launch them to Mars, and colonize Mars, boost the Heavy and the Starship. They call it the Starship. I liked his original name, the Mars Colonial Transport. That sounded really good. But then he had another couple of other names that he tried after that. But eventually he wound up with the Starship. It's not going to the stars. It'll go to the planets, but not to the stars. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N. Okay, the couple other topics here. Not as long. The last HTV, they call it. HTV. Cargo vehicle will be leaving the International Space Station this week. It's been up there for many months. It's brought up the last group of lithium-ion batteries to the space station. Massive 400-pound batteries. Each time it goes up, it brings up half a dozen lithium batteries to the space station. And it's done that four different times. But over the years, it's brought plenty of cargo, space suits and food and everything else to the space station. And roughly around 10,000 or so, maybe 11,000 pounds with each time it does that. It started launching the country that launches the HTV is Japan. Japan has launched these from their soil for the last 11 years, and they're up to the ninth one. So roughly once a year, Japan will launch a cargo vehicle to the space station to resupply the space station. They're part of the group, there's 20 countries involved with the International Space Station. A lot of people think, well, maybe it's just Russia or the United States, but there's 18 more people involved, 18 more countries involved, including Japan. So they're filling their part of the bargain for the space station right now. part of it anyway, is the final flight of this cargo version of this vehicle. And they have a new one, similar looking, but upgraded. Our HCV will be coming out within 2 years. Now, the capability of probably not only supplying fuel and food and equipment to the space station, but maybe eventually heading off to the moon to act as a cargo or resupply vehicle for them, too. Once we start going to the moon on a regular basis. So they'll be separating, and they'll load it up with junk and things to be destroyed, and they'll burn up over the South Pacific when they're ready. So right now, the only vehicles that we have coming back from the space station are two types of vehicles with people in it, the Soyuz and the Dragon by SpaceX, and the only cargo vehicles that return are SpaceX cargo vehicles, which kind of look like the crew vehicles. There's quite a bit difference.
Complete.
Let me drop it. This is WS2M. Okay. There's a new crew going up. I've mentioned this before. We're going up on the Dragon. They're going to call it the Crew 1. They're going to call it the Crew 1 mission. Crew, you know, they had demo missions. They had a demo mission that went up 2 marches ago with the Dragon to the space station. That was a manned vehicle, but it went unmanned just to see if they could do it. It went up, launched on a Falcon 9, and docked autonomously to the space station, stayed there for a couple of weeks, and then eventually undocked and landed successfully in the Atlantic Ocean. So that was Demo 1, and then followed by Demo 2, which was the exact same type of mission, but it had a crew on board, Doug Hurley and Bob Benton, and they launched end of May 30th. It's been a little over 2 months on the space station, and then they have returned successfully. You know, they were supposed to land in the Atlantic Ocean, but that storm that wiped out power here on the island, now that thing was down in the Atlantic at the time, so they chose another landing site. They had 6 possible landing sites, all in water, but they went to number 2, which was in the Gulf of Mexico. Right near Pensacola, Florida, they successfully landed, and now SpaceX is going over that spacecraft with a fine-tooth comb, make sure there's no problems. If there were, they plan on upgrading them. Crew 1 will be the first regular mission to the space station. Every time one goes up, they'll send up 4 astronauts on instead of 2 inside that Dragon, and they'll be instead of staying for a little over 2 months like Doug Hurley and Bob Mencken did, they plan on staying like 6 months. So you'll have Shannon Walker, she's been up before, KD5DXB, ham radio operator. Another astronaut will be Michael Hopkins, KF5LJG, and then Victor Glover, K15BKC, and another guy from Japan. Drop it. Sorry, Japan is heavily involved with that space station, with the cargo vehicles, and they also have two modules attached to the space station. In fact, one of them is the biggest module up there, the Kobe module. But you have Soshi Nagoshi. He's KD5CZP, so you can tell he trained in with NASA because he's got a 5 call. So you have four hams heading up there next time. Spend 6 months in space. Right now you have one guy up there that's a ham, Chris Cassidy, KF5KDR, and he'll be returning soon. they won't meet him up there. He'll be back before they go. But they will meet Dr. Kate Rubin. She's been up one other time before. She had gone up in a Soyuz vehicle and stayed for 6 months. And she's going to make a return trip also in a Soyuz vehicle. Just because we have a manned crew vehicles starting to go up on a regular basis, we still have deals with the Russians to be completed. And who knows, they might extend that for some period of time. They tend to get, complimentary. Eventually they'll probably send a Russian up. Not anytime soon right now. The head of the Russian space agency from Roscosmos said, no way, we're not going up on a new vehicle. So, they're lost. Any questions or comments? This is WS. Okay, I don't know if anybody remembers Mike Griffin. He was NASA administrator years ago. And, all things, good things come to an end. He eventually went on to other defense types of jobs in the administration. And he was they were thinking about him becoming head of the Space Force when he came up with the Space Force. But that never happened. And, of course, their political positions. They get appointed. But him, he's going to go work for a private company. Mike Griffin is a ham radio operator. He's still active, if you look him up. And R3A, QRZ, he still comes up. And he'll be, he was at ham at the time when he was working for NASA as the administrator. But now he's going to go work for a company I talk about a lot, Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab is a company that's run by Peter Beckham, another billionaire kind of guy, building these electron rockets, these Rutherford engines powered by electric motors, lithium ion batteries, and all of that, to launch small payloads to orbit. He's done that around 13 times so far. Peter Beckham launched electron rockets to get to the point where he's going to try to reuse them on number 17. Whenever number 17 goes up, it's going to launch. The booster will separate. The second stage will push the payload into orbit, but the booster will re-enter the atmosphere, and it's not going to come down vertically and, like SpaceX does. It'll come down on parachutes, float through the down through the atmosphere with his power glider on it, so he'll know exactly where it is, and not on number 17, it's just going to let hit the water, but the ones after that, maybe 18 or 19, they're going to have a helicopter go by and grab this thing out of the sky and then bring it back to land or back to a boat and put it back on a boat. Have the ship bring it back to reuse the first booster of the electron rocket from Rocket Lab. So anyway, they're going to have a lot of help because Mike Griffin has a lot of experience with NASA all those years, and now it's Defense Department. So now he's going to work for his private company. That's all I have for the space portion of the TechNet. Any comments, questions? If not, we'll turn it back to Roy. This is WS2N.
WP2EAB with a generic question.
EAB, go ahead.
Yeah, you have mentioned Boeing on the ship. Trying it out in the clear, it's not working. Okay, you've mentioned Boeing on these reports. Boeing has this black eye with the 737 MAX 8 showing all kinds of problems. Have you heard anything at all of any of this?